with a positive preparation for disaster. This is Community Alert, keeping you informed about how to be prepared, not if, but when disaster strikes. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on KZSB, AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio.
Hello again, this is Ted Adams at KZSB 1290 with my co-host Michael Williams. We're coming in today to talk to you a bit about some construction situations that are changing in the codes, and we've got a gentleman that's going to be talking with us, very knowledgeable about that. And I'm going to turn this over to Mike, and he will bring in some more information and introduce you to him.
Oh, thank you, Ted. Today we've got Chief Ron Coleman. He's the former California State Fire Marshal and currently the chairman of the IRC International Residential Code. Thank you, Chief, for taking time to speak with us today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Mike.
Thank you. I want to jump right into the meat of this. What is the IRC Sprinkler Coalition, and what can you tell us about your recent proposal, RB64? Because this is good stuff.
Well, what the coalition is a group. It's a nonprofit corporation that has been put together to continue to follow through with the idea of being very active in the code development process on a national basis to try to encourage the installation of built-in fire protection technology into single-family dwellings. Just as a matter of history, I started sprinklering houses clear back in the 1970s in the city of San Clemente. And over that last 30 years, there's been a considerable amount of communities that have started using residential sprinkler technology as a means of keeping fire losses to an absolute minimum. Well, now that we've gone to national codes, because at one point we had local codes, then we had state codes, now we have national codes. So we've had to kind of migrate upwards, and we put together a proposal that was taken to the International Residential Code Group, which is under the International Code Council, and we submitted a proposal that would put a requirement in future codes, not an existing one, but in future codes, that when single-family and multifamily dwellings are being constructed, that residential sprinklers would be incorporated in their construction. We're sort of an advocacy group, and we don't have any jurisdiction. We don't run any city or county. We're just a group of individuals interested in advocating the system.
Now, this has been a passion for you for, 25, 30 years?
It started in 1968. I was involved in two fires back-to-back. One involved a major fire in a fiberglass factory in which every sprinkler head in the building went off because they set off a 55-gallon drum of methyl ethyl ketone. And when we got there, the building was still fully intact. We squeegeed the building out, put new sprinkler heads in, and went back into business the following morning. And a couple of days later, I went on an apartment house fire in which a 13-year-old girl died within 15 feet of her front door. And I started asking myself the philosophical question is, how could we protect fiberglass boats and couldn't protect a child?
Yeah, exactly. Ted.
Chief, would you expand on why the issue of residential fire safety is of major concern for the fire service?
Well, the reality is, and most people don't have a sense of appreciation for the statistics, but the majority of the fire loss in this country, and especially the fire deaths themselves, are in residential occupancies. While we see spectacular fires, commercial ones, and there was a big fire in L.A. the other day that made national news, the reality is that the single and multifamily dwelling is the most likely place where someone's going to suffer a loss of life and property. Not only that, but the single family and multifamily dwelling is the most dangerous for firefighters to operate in. We just had two or three firefighters here in Sacramento that had to go to the hospital and have major surgery because they got caught upstairs in a single-family dwelling. And while we recognize the fire problems of major buildings like theaters and manufacturing, the reality is America's fire problem is in our living room.
So could you give us a little idea of what the difference is between residential fire sprinklers and commercial fire systems?
Well, the best way I could describe it is that a residential sprinkler system is a miniature version of a commercial system that's designed primarily to hold the fire in check for about 10 to 15 minutes. It doesn't come equipped with big, heavy valves, and it doesn't have devices you have to pump into like we pump into a major sprinkler system. So it's more or less a miniaturized version that has essentially a water supply, sprinkler heads, and some kind of a system for distributing the water. It's very basic.
So it holds the fort, if you will, until the cavalry arrives.
Pretty much that way. In fact, we've actually had a lot of head activations over those 30 years. And to date, every time we've had a head activation, the fire has been held in confinement until the fire department got there to finish the job.
Richard.
Chief, question. You said that the biggest problem is in the living room in a home. Why the living room?
No, I said, I was using it as a paraphrasing. I said, America's fire problem is in our own living room.
I understand. Okay.
Meaning that what I'm saying is that, you know, I'll put it to you this way. I would be willing to bet you there are a lot of people who are going to be listening to this show today that may, I don't know where they're going to be listening to it because I don't know what time or how this thing gets broadcast. But let's imagine that they're at home at night. And they're sitting in their living room, and they're enjoying this brief respite. And they look up, and there's maybe a smoke detector in the house, and maybe there's not. But the chances of there being sprinklers there are probably not all that good unless they're in some of our more progressive communities. But I'll be willing to bet you when they go to bed and get up the next morning and go to work, a significant number of them are going to go to work in buildings that are fully sprinklered. Okay. Matter of fact, one of my more spectacular fires is I had a fire one time with a five-year-old kid that set fire to his bed with a candle, and the sprinkler system put the fire out with the kid still in the bed. And when I talked to his father, because I was really surprised the sprinklers were in this house because it was an isolated home, and I asked the guy, I said, why do you have a sprinkler system in your house when it's not required? And he says, very simple. He said, I own about 60 movie theaters. And every one of my theaters is sprinklered to protect my occupants. He says, and my family is more important than that theater.
Absolutely. Is it the leading cause of most residential fires still in the kitchen?
Well, every year the National Fire Protection Association puts out statistics,
right.
And every year that number varies, but I would suspect, Mike, that kitchen fires, smoking fires, and fires in bedrooms, they all kind of share the bad news.
Well, I know that I was up on a vehicle fire about almost a year ago now up on East Camino Cielo, and it was late at night, and it was a new construction, and it's probably the only driveway on East Camino Cielo that you can find with the address clearly posted, with clear access, with viable turning around space, and a hydrant right out in front of the house. The structure's fully sprinklered, and his car was fully involved when we got there, and he was extraordinarily grateful that the county had actually mandated that he do all of this. He became quite a believer, because up to that point, he'd been quite an adversary on the issues of sprinklers and mandatory hydrants and his driveway and what have you. But it does work.
That's pretty common. I will tell you that I have seen more people than I can possibly actually identify in a short period of time who have become true believers once they've had an actual head activation. I'm writing a column for Sprinkler Age magazine right now about a place called the Carriage House, which is a 150-year-old restaurant back in Emmitsburg, where our National Fire Academy is, that was recently saved by a sprinkler system. And the manager of that store, or that restaurant, told me, he said, the fire marshal went from my worst enemy to my best friend in about 30 minutes.
Hmm. Very good. Ted.
Chief, where does California fall within the spectrum of sprinkler systems in residential? Are we pretty well up there, or how do you perceive us?
Well, this movement per se goes back 30 years ago to 1976. And in 1976, there was a group of individuals that kind of got on board with this concept. There was California, was led by San Clemente, California. Then we had Scottsdale, Arizona. And then we had Cobb County, Georgia. And what happened in all three of those cases, because all three of us went ahead with sprinkler technology, and then other people started picking up the gauntlet and started expanding. A good friend of mine who works for the sprinkler industry itself has done a survey. I think the last time he and I talked, there were something like 250 cities in California that had some form of residential sprinkler ordinance in place.
Well, very good. I would like to put out a website here before we go to the break. The California State Fire Marshal's website is actually HTTP, semicolon, double slash, osfm.fire.gov. That's osfm.fire.ca.gov. And all of the things we're talking about here today are readily available at that website. We're talking today with Chief Ron Coleman, former State California Fire Marshal and Chairman of the International Residential Code Coalition. We're here today with Mike Williams, Ted Adams, and Richard Dugan on the board. This is KZSB AM 1290 Community Alert. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
Hello again. This is Ted Adams at Community Alert and with Mike Williams and we have a guest today, Chief Ron Coleman, who's talking to us about sprinkler systems and sprinkling within the residential framework. I've got a question for Chief. What are the major misunderstandings that the average person has about the sprinkler performance today?
Well, that's really a pretty interesting question, because the first thing I'd like to say is that what amazes me is these myths have been around for so long, and they're so wrong. Every one of them is wrong. One of them is the idea that if one sprinkler head goes off, they all go off. That's simply not true. Fire sprinklers are activated by heat and by the flow of heat past the sprinkler head, and they're designed to go off in direct correlation to their exposure to that heat. So any assumption that if one goes off, they all go off has been perpetuated by a lot of movies and by TV series, but not by reality. The other is the amount of water that they actually put out. Quite frankly, a residential sprinkler head puts out a very, very small amount of water in controlling a fire, especially when you compare it against the amount of water put out by a fire nozzle. For example, it wouldn't be uncommon for a firefighter to, on the inside of a burning building to be putting out 125 GPM, whereas the fire sprinkler puts out about 15.
Mm-hmm.
Third one is the idea that they're difficult to maintain. Fire sprinkler systems are actually highly engineered technology. There are sprinkler systems that have been installed that are 100 years old that are still functioning. Their technology is very, very well managed. It goes through ISO, quality control, and so forth.
ISO being?
The International Standards Organization.
Thanks.
And the fact is, a built-in fire sprinkler system that's built according to code and according to the standards that we've established is a highly reliable piece of technology. And then perhaps one of the other myths is that they're really, really expensive. When it comes to putting them into new homes, and I've actually been doing this now literally for three decades, I've seen the price plummet from what it originally started out as, because it's now becoming part of part of the construction industry's ability to deliver. But it can go as little as a dollar a square foot. Granted, there's some parts of the country where it might be a little higher than that, but when you start comparing it to such things as granite upgrades, or putting carpet in your house, or having stained glass windows or something like that, it's a relatively inexpensive level of protection.
Chief, is the public able to install a sprinkler system that isn't mandated by a code requirement, but in a home, in just particular locations in the home, or is it necessary for them to put the sprinkler systems throughout the home if they install anything?
Well, the way the systems are designed, we discourage partial systems, because they can be overcome by flashover or whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, we recommend everybody take a very close look at NFPA Standard 13D, mm-hmm. which is a standard that's published by the National Fire Protection Association that most contractors and most other individuals are very, very knowledgeable on.
Is there any reason that a person couldn't put in their own sprinkler system, assuming he had access to the plumbing and he knew how to do plumbing? Would that be acceptable, or is that something that would never get through the permitting process?
Well, I'm not sure I know how to answer that, Mike, and I'll tell you why. Most of the time, we're not talking about home-built solutions here.
Right.
I will tell you that I sprinkled two of my houses, and I did it myself.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it can be done.
It can be done. There are some interesting new changes in technology. There's new valves that are on the market. There's new sprinkler heads, because they do require, a residential application does require a different type of head than a commercial head. They're called QRSs, quick response sprinklers.
Chief, I live back in the mountains, and most of the communities around me are supplied with wells and their own gravity flow systems. Mm-hmm. Have they come up with any systems that require a lower pressure than the systems used to? Because I know that they were up around 35, 40 pounds at one time, and that kind of restricted some of the areas in order to have systems.
Well, there are low-flow heads. There are ones that can be calculated. The big issue with rural is more along the lines of water tank, mm-hmm. More than anything else. We have a system called a 13D tank that can be installed that operates off of a balance off of a well.
Mm-hmm.
Being rural, I actually have said this before, so I don't mind repeating it here, but being rural, you need a residential sprinkler system more than anybody.
Absolutely.
Because you may not have a fire truck for an hour.
Well, that's why we want to make it easy and uncomplicated for people to consider and giving them options. So,
well, we've done a videotape that we'd be happy to share with people if anybody would want to answer those kinds of questions.
Mm-hmm.
How would they get a copy of that, or is there a website they can go to?
There is a website. We have a group. Our website's called the International Residential Code Fire Sprinkler Coalition, and our website is http://ircfiresprinkler.org. And if you send us an email or make contact with us, we have a contact there. It's called admin@ircfiresprinkler.org. We have a phone number, 202-470-6447. And we'd be happy. We've given away about 10,000 of these DVDs, so a few more won't hurt.
Well, I've got a couple at the office myself, and they're great CDs. I would encourage people to follow up on this offer and get them. A question off the list here. One of the leading causes of fatalities in structure fires is the smoke inhalation, not necessarily the fire. And how does a sprinkler system help in alleviating that risk to an occupant who's perhaps asleep or what have you?
Yeah, well, one of the first things I want to point out, Mike, is we never suggest that a sprinkler system is a warning system. That's what smoke detectors
absolutely
are for. And we have a commitment to the concept we kind of refer to as the systems approach,
mm-hmm.
and that is that we believe that you've got to have an active and operating smoke detector in your home. And then secondarily, once a fire does occur, once it reaches a certain level of heat and the fire is extinguished by the fire, you'll still have smoke, but it's a survival atmosphere. I've actually conducted hundreds of burns with people in the room with me. In fact, I did it on Bob Villa's show,
mm-hmm.
One we do on construction.
Right.
And the level of toxicity just doesn't get there fast enough to be able to do harm to people. It's not uncommon in a lot of cases for a sprinkler head to go off, not too much fast where the smoke detector goes off. Kind of mm-hmm. depends on how fast the flame spreads.
Maybe it'd be good to talk briefly about how a sprinkler head's activated. What's the mechanics involved?
Well, a sprinkler head essentially is a mechanical device that holds a nozzle attached to the end of a hose, or not the end of a hose, the end of a pipe.
Yeah.
And that pipe is restricted in with some kind of a mechanism that is heat sensitive. We call it a link. Now, the link can be made out of any number of materials. We have glass bulb heads that have a little glass bulb in there that holds that link closed. We have some that are metal with solder. We have different configurations. But the idea is that these are very sensitive to rises in temperature. In the case of the glass bulb, for example, when the bulb gets heated, the material inside the bulb expands until it finally breaks. Mm-hmm. When it breaks, a little cap will pop off of the pipe, and the nozzle, which is otherwise known as the sprinkler head, will start working.
Chief, is there any break that comes with installing a system as far as your fire insurance is concerned?
Well, the answer to that is kind of depend on who the agent is and how knowledgeable the company is. We have had experience that several of the companies have offered discounts for residential sprinklers, and I do happen to know that the insurance industry looks upon sprinklers in a more favorable fashion than, say, they did 20 years ago. They're actually currently considering making it part of their evaluation of a city's fire defenses as to whether or not sprinklers are being used.
Excellent.
And that generally, I mean, I can't give you a dollar and cent value unless you talk to the policyholder.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, this is Community Alert. If you're interested in participating in Community Alert for future programs, you can give the Wildland residents a call at 964-7194. That's 964-7194. You can send us an email at community@wildlandresidents.org. That's wildlandresidents.org. We'd be happy to take your questions off the air and perhaps get some guests to answer your specific issues. This is Community Alert with Mike Williams, Ted Adam, Richard Dugan working the levels for us today. We're talking with Chief Ron Coleman. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
The views expressed on Community Alert are not necessarily those of the staff, management, ownership, or advertisers of this station.
Hello again. This is Ted Adams with Mike Williams and Chief Ron Coleman talking to us this afternoon about sprinkler systems and some of the things that we can do in our homes to help prevent the disaster of fire in the home. So I'm going to turn this over to Mike, and he's got some questions for the Chief.
Chief, regarding these proposed code changes, I know that you're talking about not being a regulatory agency, but you do have a significant impact on those people that do make the final decisions. Now that this Proposal 64 has gone through, what do you see happening next?
Well, what will occur next, because we have a national code thrust these days, is that that code will then be taken to the different states of the union and various other locations that adopt it, and it will go through an adoption process at that level. For example, the state of California will be considering it in about a year and a half, something like that. That will result in some dialogue and probably some meaningful debate amongst the advocates and the adversaries of the residential sprinkler movement. Our strategy is to put on a full court press right now to educate and inform the public and to educate and inform fire departments about what they could do to support this effort. And be as adequately prepared as we can when it comes up for state adoption. Then once it's adopted by the states, depends on whether it's a mini-maxi state or a local control state, the next level of adoption consists of whether or not the locals want to take a shot at it. For example, in California, the reason I was able to put sprinklers in San Clemente in the 70s was we're a local control state. And I was able to write an ordinance and get it adopted without anybody from another level actually having any impact on it. That'll be what will occur in many cases. It'll be different departments. In fact, I hear from departments all the time that are currently working on an ordinance, not even waiting on this to come through with the code process.
Sure. Well, it makes just perfect sense. Now, this kind of parallels some other changes that are coming with building materials, isn't it?
Oh, heavens, yes. I think that the single-family dwelling is going to undergo quite a transition in the next 10 or 20 years in terms of what it means to have a fire in it.
All right. Well, this is all good stuff. How long do you think the code proposal is going to take before you actually start seeing it hitting the streets here in California?
3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years. Who do you see as the major adversarial forces, if you will, in trying to prevent this or slowing it down?
Well, there are any number of people who oppose it for a variety of reasons. I would characterize the building and development community as being very concerned about it because they perceive that on their part that it's going to be another complication. One of the things I would like to point out is our coalition group is working very hard to try to work on trade-offs and find ways of actually helping developers build safer buildings more inexpensively. But not everybody agrees with that assumption or even that direction. So there's going to be different people. We even have fire people that don't agree with it.
I have a question for you. This is Richard. How old is this fire sprinkler technology? You say you've been installing since the early 70s.
Yeah.
So it's obviously been around for a good 30, almost 40 years.
If I told you a story you probably wouldn't believe, you might have me to make me prove it, so I'm prepared to.
Okay.
I've actually got an advertisement out of the Saturday Evening Post from 1907 talking about residential sprinklers.
Wow.
That's cool.
That's impressive.
It would seem that the insurance industry would be highly favorable of all of this.
You would think so.
Yeah, because obviously they insure the property and they have an interest in making sure it survives.
So, Chief, is this going to be implemented through the building departments? Is that the way it would work? It would be just another requirement when someone came in for a permit to put this in the plans. The architects would be doing that sort of thing?
That is correct. In fact, we've actually heard from several architects now who, now that they recognize this is coming, they want more information.
So what do we say to the naysayer that says, oh, this is great, the sprinkler goes off and it actually causes more damage than the fire? What do we say to that person? Because they're out there.
You know, I don't want to be flippant about that, but but I will tell you that it's better to be wet than dead.
That's correct.
I've been in this business for 47 years, and I've gone on a lot of fire calls, and I've seen a lot of good things happen. I've seen a lot of bad things happen. And I've also been on a lot of automobile wrecks, and I have often compared the residential sprinkler movement to the whole idea of seatbelts and airbags.
Good analogy, yes.
The industry fought both of them bitterly because they felt that they were unnecessary. Once they were actually part and parcel of the delivery system, now everybody brags about how many airbags they can cram in their car.
So, Chief, sprinklers are just, and you mentioned a few minutes ago that the codes are going to change in a number of ways. Do you think you could share with us some of the other ways that they may be changing the way that we build our homes? Have you got something you can share with us there?
Oh, yeah. I've got my interest is not just in sprinklers. I've also been keeping track of things such as lightweight wood construction, what it means to firefighters and homeowners. I've been tracking the
issue. Could you explain us what lightweight wood construction would be?
Well, what lightweight wood construction is an engineered wood product that is fabricated from components that can provide strength to a building but may not be the same bulk and depth and dimension of old dimensional lumber. A good example would be an I-joist.
Mm-hmm.
If you put in a 2x8, that's one thing. But if you have an engineered wood product, it would have a web and a flange made of materials that would be far lesser in mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then these are assembled as engineered wood products.
So you'd be reducing the fuel load, actually.
You're actually reducing the fuel load, but you're also increasing the exposure of the area of the fuel.
I see.
And engineered wood products do create certain specific things that fire officers ought to be paying attention to. One of the things, I don't know if many of you guys have been a structural firefighter, but I'll tell you that the spans in houses today are significantly different than they were in homes 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's the distance between support members and the structure.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't get a 40-foot tree.
Right.
But now you can get an engineered wood joist that will cover extremely broad spans.
Well,
And then another issue that I'm also concerned with is solar energy, because I believe that solar energy and electrical cars and all these other things are going to have an effect on how houses are built in the future.
Well, you know, electrical brings up a whole nother world. And I look at solar panel, I think batteries. Batteries is what it is. Mm-hmm. And that presents a whole new world of hazardous materials and exposure and risk. And I'm sure you're addressing those things.
Well, I'll put it this way. Not only do solar panels represent batteries, but they also mean hot wires.
Yes. It's a challenge for firefighters on the roof. It's going to require them to change their methodology. If they pull up to a structure with numerous solar panels on the roof, ventilation is going to become a new tactic, isn't it?
Well, I think that that's coupled with some other things. I'll give you just a couple of scenarios. Number one is energy efficiency of homes is causing homes to be much more buttoned up than they used to be.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes.
And when you get a house that's really buttoned up and you get a fire in that house that goes to pretty high level of fire involvement, it potentials for backdrafting conditions that are pretty common.
Well, how does a fire typically spread in your traditional, say, 1,800, 2,000 square foot home? What do people have to look at? We got about a minute here, so.
Okay, well, when a fire starts, it starts originally, usually, as a small single point. I'm discounting arson, of course, with a
sure.
splash job, but a single point that is, it begins to accumulate heat. It's called a low challenge fire. It starts putting out heat, radiant heat flux, and convected heat. And as the convected heat starts going up further and further up into the atmosphere, a fire generally spreads vertically very, very rapidly until it reaches a surface and then starts to flatten out and starts to spread horizontally. So if a fire is caught when it's in a low challenge stage, you might be able to put it out with a teacup of water. But 5 minutes later, when you've got flame height of 3 feet off the floor, it's not going to be that easy.
Well, hence all the more reason to have a sprinkler, because that's your teacup of water.
Well, the sprinkler heads activate, and yeah. I've done hundreds of these fires with these heads. They usually activate at a stage in which the fire is still in a low challenge stage.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough to scare somebody, but it's not enough to threaten their life.
Oh, absolutely. So, well, we got a break for a break here. We're with Chief Ron Coleman, former California State Fire Marshal and current chairman of the IRC International Residential Code. It's Mike Williams, Ted Adams, and Richard Dugan on the board. If you're interested in contributing to Community Alert, you can send a donation to 5655 West Camino Cielo. That's 5655 West Camino Cielo, Santa Barbara, California, 93105. Community Alert is a collaborative effort between the Wildland Residents Association and the Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council. This is Community Alert. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
Hello again, this is Community Alert, KZSB 1290. This is Ted Adams with Michael Williams, and today's guest, Chief Ron Coleman, and we're talking about a number of things with some changes in codes and changes in the structure of how we're dealing with fire in the home. Chief, I'd like to talk a little bit about the solar. We started to talk a little bit about photovoltaics and solar and how that's going to affect some of the firefighting methods and some of the maybe downside of having solar panels on your roof.
Well, I'm not sure I'd want to use the word downside of on the roof, because I think that green buildings and energy policy are going to drive a lot of these things. I think what my concern would be not so much that it's occurring as much as it's how we have to be prepared for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the key with solar energy, for example, is those panels are going to be put on rooftops, or they're going to be put into arrays that we have to know how to cope with them. You just can't go up there and take a K-12 and start rearranging a solar panel.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I think that this introduces some new training requirements for the fire service. I know for a fact that the industry has been working with fire officials to talk about things such as making sure that certain portions of the building were left open so that we could perform vertical ventilation. I do believe that, and this is just my opinion, this is not anybody else's opinion, I do believe that the whole concept of vertical ventilation in fighting fires is going to undergo a transition in the next couple of decades. And I think it's going to have a lot to do with roof construction and the solar panel problem per se, accompanied by construction methodologies with modular construction and so forth. And I'm just saying that fire departments have to be very, very aware of what's going on. You know, they shouldn't be just driving by and looking at a bunch of brand new homes and saying, gee, I wonder what that black thing is on the roof.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They ought to be stopping. They ought to go to the model homes. They ought to meet with the installers, and they ought to say, well, you know, where's the shutoff switch to this thing?
When you talk about vertical ventilation, for the benefit of our listeners, what are you referring to?
Well, it's the standard methodology that most fire agencies have been using for years in this country, and that is to get up at the highest point of the building and let the fire out of the building. You chop a hole in the roof, you open up a staircase, you do whatever you can to get the fire and the heated gases to go out the top.
Right, based on the premise that hot air rises.
Based on the premise that the hot air rises.
Correct. Okay, now you're getting into the area of fire prevention, and this is not always the number one priority for a lot of fire agencies. This is going to lay kind of some changes in the way they do business, isn't it?
Mike, it ought to be.
Because fire suppression and fire prevention are almost going in different directions sometimes when you look at where the priorities are.
Well, that's probably true. And I get into this discussion a lot with people. But let me just remind you that the word fire prevention is kind of a misnomer. Once a fire starts, there's no prevention.
Right.
What we're really talking about is risk mitigation,
mm-hmm.
and risk management and risk control. And things are changing in our world of firefighting. I can tell you that I keep track of a lot of really almost totally mystical statistics. And one of them, for example, is the size of a single-family dwelling for a what they call a starter home, mm-hmm. has changed significantly in the last 25 to 30 years. It used to be about 1,500 to 1,700 square feet. Now it's up around 2,500.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's because of lightweight construction allowing bigger scans, et cetera. Now, residential structure fire deaths in the period of about, I'd say about the last 10 years, has actually gone down. But we still lose about 3,000 people a year in residential structure fire deaths. That's like crashing a 747 once every other month.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's a lot of people. So
that's a lot of people.
When we talk about fire prevention and mitigation and risk management, that's a big issue here in Santa Barbara, as you know, and I know you're very familiar with Santa Barbara.
Yes, I am.
And that's where the Fire Safe Council has been extraordinarily active in mitigation efforts, and the WRA is certainly one of the leaders on that. What do you see changing in the wildland-urban interface as it relates to areas that you're currently working?
Well, the main theme in the urban-wildland interface, and I'm going to give you my opinion, this doesn't appear in any document anywhere, but it has to do with the fact that we've got to make a building defend itself. The biggest problem we've got in California is when we have these major fires, we have more buildings to protect than we have fire trucks to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the buildings have got to be more defensible. This introduces a concept of, for example, shelter-in-place concepts that some communities are experimenting with. It also means that we've got to be going back and retrofitting some of our older homes to deal more effectively with brand showers. We've got to pay an awful lot of attention to vegetation management and defensible space. I don't call it defensible space anymore because there's hardly anybody there to defend it. I call it survivable space.
Well, that's a good idea, yes.
Because, quite frankly, and you know this, but you've been on fires where there's a whole ridge line of buildings on fire, and there's like 12 fire trucks up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a virtually impossible scenario unless the building has taken into consideration those mitigation measures they can control themselves.
Well, we certainly saw that during the Gap Fire, because the Gap Fire was up on West Camino Cielo and was burning down into the area of Goleta that I know you're familiar with. And the defensible space that was done primarily at Windermere Ranch was very profound. It kept it out of the entire Haney track and pushed it down the hill into an area where at least they could get us some containment efforts on it. So it absolutely works, and there's places we can take people to show, and yet there's still resistance to it. That's the baffling part.
Yeah, well, just as long as they keep the fire out of Moss Motors, I'm okay.
Well, you know, one of the things I notice here in the State Farm brochure that's put out, I ought to remind folks that get a copy of this, it's called Living with Wildfire, a guide for homeowners in Santa Barbara County, and it's co-sponsored by the Fire Safe Council as well as State Farm Insurance, and that's available on the County Fire website, County website, as well as the WRA website. There's been almost a million acres, well, certainly half a million acres burned in Santa Barbara County since 1950, and there's been less than 1,000 homes lost.
Yep.
So prevention works, and I see this as something that statistically it's supported, and yet people want to fight it. So we've got to take a break here, Chief. This is KZSB AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press Radio. This is Community Alert with Mike Williams, Ted Adams, and Richard Dugan on the board. And we'll be back with you in just a moment.
The views expressed on Community Alert are not necessarily those of the staff, management, ownership, or advertisers of this station.
Welcome back to Community Alert. This is Ted Adams and Mike Williams here with our guest Ron Coleman. We're talking about some of the new code requirements and things that are coming down the pike at us. And so I'm going to turn this over to Mike. He's going to take it from here.
Before we get back to the chief, I'd like to put out two websites here. And I'll say them slow so you have time to read them. There's an enormous amount of information available on both of these websites that if you're interested in the topics of sprinklers or solar panels or current building construction techniques or mandates, you can get them off either one of these sites. The first is the California Department of Forestry Fire Protection, better known as CAL FIRE's State Fire Marshal website, and that's at http://OSFM, that's OSFM.fire.ca.gov. You can also go to the CAL FIRE home website, which has a lot of your urban information in it, at www.fire.ca.gov. And truth be known, you can get to the State Fire Marshal site through the CAL FIRE site. Both of those have excellent sources of information and links and downloadable information. You can spend a good part of a day going through both of those. So back to the chief. Chief, if you could repeat your website and telephone number for our guests so that they can understand the best places to go to get information, because there's no way we're going to cover this all in one day.
No, as a matter of fact, our website also has a link network that takes you to a whole bunch of other sites also. We have about 100 entities that we're working with, and some of their websites cover some of these same topics. Our website is http://IRC Fire Sprinkler, that's all one word, .org. And if you go there, we have a section that talks about resources and other links, and there's documents there that you can download that talk about some of these concepts and so forth. And I recommend anybody try it.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, the IRC that you're chairman of, you work with various other organizations. What are some of the primary players that you're working with?
Well, when it comes to the number of people that we operate with, I can actually give you a kind of a thumbnail sketch. It ranges everywhere from American Burn Association, Campus Fire Safety Groups, ICC, Fire Service Review Committee, Institution of Fire Engineers, IAT, International Association of Fire Chiefs, International Association of Firefighters. In fact, Sean DeCray, who is a very active member from the Chicago Fire Department, is a participant on our group. We have Safe Kids USA, Society of Fire Protection Engineers. We have right now 100 entities in 45 states.
Okay, so you're a broad coalition representing all the different aspects of this issue.
I'd like to make it broader.
Now, you're still consulting with the State Fire Marshal's Office in California, too, on these same issues, correct?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call what I do with the Fire Marshal's Office consulting. I'm a member of one of their committees, and I chair their statewide training education advisory council, and I still work with the staff down there on a variety of things.
Well, we'll have to have you back about training, because training is a subject in and unto itself, and certainly one of my passions, because I think training applies to all aspects of the fire service, both internally and externally, as far as how we are perceived by the public, as well as getting public support and how we approach problems.
Well, Mike, we have a motto for that. What happens without training?
Nothing. Nothing. Failure.
Well, the public needs to be trained as well. We don't want to forget that.
Failure is not an option, especially when we get into the arena of public safety and the property. So any closing comments you'd like to share with the audience? We're coming up on our last 2 minutes here.
Well, the one thing that I just heard someone mention about training the public is absolutely essential. I think that the level of community awareness has to go up. You see, fire safety is not about losing things anymore. It's about the quality of life in a community. And while I'm pretty heavily involved in the technological aspects of it, I'm really more interested in making sure that Mr. and Mrs. Homeowner have a place to go back to if they have a fire, they have a neighborhood to go back to if they have a wildland fire, and they've got a community they can come back to if there's a conflagration.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Chief, I'd like to thank you for taking time out to be with us today on Community Alert. I appreciate that you're extremely busy and you're on the road frequently, and so I appreciate the time you've taken with us. If you're interested in helping support the Community Alert radio program, you can send a tax-deductible donation to us at 5655 West Camino Cielo, 93105. Again, that's 5655 West Camino Cielo. You can give us a call at 964-7194 or send us an email at community@wildlandresidents.org if you'd like to make a contribution into content. Next week, we've got Tom Faham, Deputy Public Works Director, and William Boyer, Communications Director for Santa Barbara County. They'll be talking about potential winter flooding and prevention issues in the Goleta area. This is Community Alert with Mike Williams, Ted Adams, and Richard Dugan on the board on KZSB AM 1290 Santa Barbara News Press Radio.
This has been Community Alert. Community Alert is produced by the Santa Barbara County Fire Safe Council in association with the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department. Production assistance provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. This is KZSB AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.